You can suffer in silence, or you can take the medicine that will relieve some of your discomfort and let you sleep. Which do you think I'd prefer?
Insolent, Xavier snapped. Give me the glass.
When she had drained it, she sat back against the pillows.
Disgusting.
Mary Augustine poured another glass of water from the pitcher. This too, she said. It's important to keep your humors in balance. When the second glass had been emptied, Mary Augustine checked her dressing and went about the small things she could do to make the older nun comfortable.
You watched the whole operation, I suppose?
I did.
And?
Mary Augustine sat down on the stool beside the bed. What do you want to know?
Sister Xavier flapped a hand impatiently. Don't be dense. Tell me what she did, your Dr. Savard.
It was difficult to know where to start, how much detail to provide, whether it was her place to offer conclusions, or if she should simply refuse to talk about the surgery itself. But it seemed to her that Sister Xavier had a right to know. Dr. Savard made room for me to stand beside her and watch, she began. Every minute was fresh in her memory, but Mary Augustine had the sense that it didn't matter how much time passed. She would remember it all, detail by detail. It was a revelation to watch Dr. Savard's hands moving very quickly and surely while she explained exactly what she was doing in a calm, methodical way. She had pointed out different types of vessels and tissues and the tumor itself, an encapsulated mass the size of a lemon.
A lemon? Sister Xavier interrupted her. It felt far bigger to me.
It was easily removed, which is good news. No blood vessels involved. She used a fresh cloth to wipe the perspiration from Sister Xavier's forehead until her hand was batted away.
Where is it?
Pardon?
Where's the tumor they took out of me?
It was dissected and is being studied under a microscope. And she hoped that this would be enough information, because as curious as Sister Xavier was, Mary Augustine doubted she wanted to know about the tumor that had broken open like a bad egg on the laboratory table. When she turned to look, the pain lines between Sister Xavier's brows had lessened, and she blinked.
You are a good nurse, she said, in an almost pleasant tone of voice. I hope you won't regret giving it up.
Chapter 14. On Saturday morning, just before 10, Sophie turned onto Park Place and came to a stop. For more than a year, she had been avoiding this corner for fear that she might see Cap, and for fear that she might not. Now she took a moment to catch her breath. The house was as it had always been, classical in its lines and elegant, the counterpoint to new mansions springing up along Fifth Avenue, where excess had become a religion. Here, nothing had changed, and nothing was the same. For days, she had been reminding herself that the Cap she knew so well was gone. This man she was going to marry would look nothing like the boy she had grown up with. Where her Cap had been strong and lithe and restless, this man would sit quietly. He would be gaunt and flushed and feverish, and he would cough until he was bloody with it. What she could do for him medically was limited, but she could give him some peace of mind. She would look at him and not see the illness. She would put that aside and concentrate on the man held hostage by the disease. The familiar gave her some comfort. The gardens that framed the front of the house, perfectly kept, backed with blossoming magnolia trees. Each flower stood proudly upright like a fat pink candle on a leafless branch. Mrs. Harrison's beloved pansies overflowed the pots standing sentry to either side of the door, as old-fashioned and sweet as the housekeeper herself. As soon as Sophie set foot on the walkway, before she could think about knocking, the front door opened and gave her the day's first surprise.
Cap's Uncle Conrad stood beaming at her, and just behind him were Bram and Baltus Decker, Cap's cousins and best friends. The Decker twins, who had been as unruly as wild ponies as children, had not changed much with age.
"Here she is, Uncle."
Bram touched Conrad's elbow as Sophie approached. The older man's mouth quirked in a familiar expression.
"I'm blind, Bram," he said with his usual great dignity. "Not deaf. I hear her."
He held out both hands, and Sophie took them.
"Sophie, my dear," he said softly. High time indeed."
"You look surprised to see us," Baltus said, kissing Sophie's cheek. "Did you imagine we'd miss the fun?"
"Cap wanted us here at 7 in case you came to breakfast," his brother added. "But you didn't, and so we had to do right by Mrs. Mack's pancakes without you."
Conrad said,
"You see, these two are as measured and mature as ever, Sophie. You should go ahead. Cap is waiting for you."
"Give a shout when you're ready," Bram said, "and we'll bring the photographer up, if he ever gets here."
Sophie stopped short. "Photographer?"
"For the engagement announcement. Got to have a picture," says Cap, quite insistent.
Sophie looked from Bram to Baltus to Conrad.
"The family hasn't been told yet,"
Conrad said, as if she had put a question into words.
"But that's not something to worry you. Go on now, he's waiting for you."
Sophie got no farther than the first landing, where Mrs. Harrison was waiting, her eyes red-rimmed and damp. At the sight of Sophie, two teardrops rolled down her cheeks.
"Miss Sophie," she said, "it's so good to see you. So good I could just cry."
"You are crying, Mrs. Harrison."
Sophie took her handkerchief from her cuff and blotted the old woman's cheeks.
"How's your lumbago?"
"Never mind about me," said Mrs. Harrison,
waving a hand as if to discourage a fly. She picked up a small silver tray from the table beside her and held it out to Sophie. There was a mask of fine mesh and a pair of gloves. Both smelled vaguely of carbolic acid. Sophie was not surprised that Cap would have made such arrangements, but Mrs. Harrison looked embarrassed.
"It's perfectly all right," Sophie said. "I don't mind at all."
It was a lie. She hated the fact that such things were necessary, but she would not make a fuss over something that could not be changed.
"Miss Sophie..."
Miss Harrison's voice trembled. Sophie reminded herself that Mrs. Harrison had raised Cap. She had been in the household when he was born and when his parents died, and all throughout his Aunt May's tenure. When Cap left this house for Europe, she would never see him again.
"Yes. He's weak," she said, "but he's settled. I couldn't say comfortable, but he's so much more settled since... Well, now that you're here, he's content."
Content was a word Sophie disliked intensely. Content was constrained and devoid of hope for more or better. Content would not do for Cap. But she nodded and thanked the housekeeper for her help, and then she went up to him. Without hesitation, Sophie opened the door, walked into Cap's room, and then quietly closed the door behind herself. It was a gesture more telling than any other, that they should close themselves off alone in a room. She took a moment to contemplate the significance of this simple thing, and then she turned to the windows. He sat in a high-backed armchair, a folded blanket over his lap. He was smiling at her as she smiled at him behind her mask. The idea came to her just then that he would never see her face again, and that was simply unacceptable. Sophie let the mask drop to hang around her neck and walked toward him. She saw his expression shift from confusion to wariness to distress, and stopped just short of anger because by then she had knelt beside his chair and put her hands on his shoulders, leaned forward, and touched her cheek to his. "Oh, no," he said, his voice just a whisper. "No, Sophie. You shouldn't have come if you can't keep yourself safe from me."
But he held on to her with all the meager strength of his arms, and Sophie was glad. She was glad to hold him like this, as little as it was. She got up and went back to sit on the chair that had been made ready for her on the other side of the room. When she had mastered her voice, she raised her face and looked at him.
"You have to promise not to do that again," he said.
"I can't make that promise."
There was a small silence between them. Sophie waited, and then she said,
"Did you think I would have no conditions of my own?"
He rested his cheek on the wing of the chair, his gaze unwavering. "Tell me," he said finally, "what measures you are willing to take to protect your health."
Sophie took a sheet of paper from her reticule and, walking across the room once again, put it on the table where he could reach it, turned, and went back to her chair.
Cap took the paper and read, his brow creased and disapproving. There was a familiar tick at the corner of his mouth. She was trying his patience, which was exactly her intention.
"I can't agree to this first point. We cannot eat at the same table," he said.
"We can," Sophie corrected him, "but not from the same serving dishes or plates."
"Then you will wear a mask, or I will."
"That will make eating quite a challenge."
He glared at her and turned back to her list. As he read, the corner of his mouth jerked in something that went beyond irritation. All the way, Sophie was beginning to hope, to a resigned amusement.
"I will concede to points 1 through 8, he said. "But we cannot sleep in the same room. It's just too dangerous."
Sophie turned away for a moment, her eyes moving over the familiar four walls of this room he had had for all his life. Nothing changed here. Books and paintings, the fossils and seashells and minerals brought back from his travels, carvings and small sculptures. She touched the chunk of raw amazonite brought back from a trip to the West, he said, because it was exactly the same blue-green color of her eyes. She was making him wait for an answer, and found that it suited her to take her time. She stopped in front of a portrait of his mother at age 19 in 1854. Newly married against her father's express wishes, already carrying Cap. In this photograph, Clorinda Belmont always struck Sophie as somber or even mournful, as if she knew that the time left to her was short. She would lose her husband before their son was born, and then succumb to influenza in the first year of the war. It had occurred to Sophie that Cap was following her example in marrying against his family's wishes. She wondered if the comparison would irritate or please him.
"I will take all precautions," Sophie said finally, going back to her chair. "But I am talking only about sharing a room, not a bed. Think very carefully before you respond, because I am prepared. I will go away."
She folded her hands in her lap and watched him thinking.
"I will go away," she repeated to herself.
She couldn't pretend to be a lawyer, but she was proud of this flexible turn of phrase. He said,
"There's a box on the table beside you."
"So I see."
"Aren't you going to open it?"
"You haven't finished reading my list."
There was something in the way he turned his head, something off.
"You're taking laudanum."
A spark of irritation moved across his face and then was banished.
"I didn't want to cough during this interview."
"Paregoric or tincture?"
He gave her a crooked grin.
I thought you might ask. It tastes of saffron and cloves. From Mr. Cunningham, a reputable apothecary, you told me once.
This was the Cap she knew, good-natured even when he had been found out in a scheme. He wouldn't lie. He considered it beneath his dignity. As a boy of 12, he had once explained himself to Mrs. Lee. A good lawyer, he said, can achieve his end without resorting to a lie. Mrs. Lee had laughed. But Aunt Quinlan had frowned, and later took Cap aside to discuss the ways that manipulation made a mockery of honesty.
From now on, I will oversee the compounding of whatever medication you need, without interference. So where do we stand?
I will concede on the medication,
as if I'd allow anything else.
He raised a brow. And I will concede on sharing a bedroom. But the arrangement of the room and the beds is mine.
The rest of it?
He glanced at her list.
I agree to the other points.
Without reservation?
Of course I have reservations, he said, but I am willing to compromise.
You will concede to my decisions in medical matters?
Yes, I said I would.
She allowed herself a smile.
You have the same scowl now you do when you're losing at cards.
Cap's glare was both affronted and amused. He said,
Another condition occurs to me. We must see each other every day until we leave for Europe.
It would be difficult to manage, but Sophie nodded.
Now will you open the box?
She knew what he was offering her. There was a portrait of his mother in the parlor in her wedding gown. She wore pearls and emeralds at her ears and around her neck, and a wedding ring that had at its center a diamond that had come down through the Belmont line. That very ring was in the small box he wanted her to open and then to put on her hand. When the photographer came to take their portrait, Cap would want it in plain sight, because the ring made all things clear in ways words could not.
Sophie said, I am so angry at you.
He inclined his head, but there was no confession forthcoming.
When did you first write to Dr. Zengerle?
He waved a hand, as if the question should be shooed away like a fly. A year ago.
What a lot of time to waste when every minute is so precious.
She made her voice firm. His gaze was sharper now.
Last year at this time, would you have agreed to go to Switzerland as my wife?
And then,
you know you wouldn't have. So will you wear the damn ring or not?
Sophie opened the box and looked at this ring she had never thought to wear.
I know, Cap said. It's truly hideous.
The ring his mother and grandmother had worn had a yellow diamond as its centerpiece. The stone was set against foil on a wrought silver band, with sapphires to either side that only made the stone look more yellow. Sophie bit her lip and then laughed out loud.
I could have the stone reset, he said.
Do you think it would make a difference, really?
He lifted a shoulder in agreement.
Any number of women would put this ring on without hesitation and declare it the prettiest thing ever made by man.
But tomorrow their fathers would look up from the morning paper and say, Cap Verhoeven is going to marry that mulatto woman.
She slipped the ring onto her finger, her hands chapped and a little swollen, as they always were. Like gliding a wooden nickel, as Mrs. Lee would put it. Cap's ring pinched just slightly. When Anna came into the dining room on Saturday evening, Aunt Quinlan had already taken her place at the head of the table, with Margaret and Sophie to either side. The little girls, Margaret told her in a subdued tone, had had their supper and baths and were already settled for the night. From the looks of things, there was an argument going on. Anna said, You know how I dislike coming in on the middle, so start again, please. At the beginning, What are we arguing about?
We aren't arguing, Aunt Quinlan said in a tone that said just the opposite.
This isn't about a corset for Rosa, is it?
Somehow it was the right thing to say, because Aunt Quinlan and Sophie both gave a startled laugh. Margaret continued to frown into her soup bowl.
No, Sophie said. It's not about that at all.
She drew in a deep breath.
I saw Cap today. We're going to Switzerland.
Anna got up, went to Sophie, and hugged her hard enough to make her protest. She picked up her cousin's hand and looked at the ring.
You must really love the man if you're willing to wear this ring. It's awful.
I know, Sophie said, grinning.
Agreement on all points, with some very small concessions on both sides.
Anna, you'll break my ribs.
Does his family know?
The announcement will be in tomorrow's paper, but Cap's aunts and cousins will already have received word by messenger before that point. This is no surprise to you, Margaret said to Anna, her brow pulled down in displeasure.
Of course not.
Anna hugged Sophie again and returned to her place, where she fell into her chair with an unladylike plop. She couldn't stop smiling. She smiled through the kisses and hugs and tears. She smiled especially when Mr. Lee came into the dining room, something he almost never did, despite many invitations, and took Sophie's hand between his own two hands and wished her every good thing.
We must have wine to toast the happy couple, said her aunt. All of us.
This is hardly something to celebrate without reservation, Margaret said irritably.
Margaret, Aunt Quinlan said. Two young people who love each other are getting married. That is something to celebrate.
Margaret waited until Mr. Lee had left the room, shifting uneasily. Anna thought of suggesting to her that her corset was too tightly cinched, a childish impulse that made her want to laugh anyway. Before Margaret could get started with her questions, Anna asked what seemed to her the crucial question.
Margaret, why do you object?
Aunt Quinlan answered for her stepdaughter.
Margaret is upset because Sophie is the only Catholic among us, and she thinks the Catholic Church won't let the little girls stay if she leaves.
Margaret is upset, Margaret said, because it is unfair. We should never have allowed the girls to stay if we weren't all prepared to stay with them. Just last week, the Catholic Church took a baby away from a Protestant couple. It was in the papers, if you don't believe me.
There's more to that story, Aunt Quinlan said. The mother left a note with the boy asking that he be raised Catholic.
According to the nuns, Margaret muttered. Are you suggesting that Sophie sent Cap off to Switzerland alone?
Anna was careful not to inject anything dismissive in her tone, but Margaret was determined to be insulted.
Cap is a grown man, able to fend for himself, she said.
There was a small but fraught silence, while Anna tried to reconcile what she was hearing with the Margaret she had always known. Not the most effective or consistent of mothers to her two boys, but deeply devoted. Stubborn, yes. A martyr to social convention, but not willfully cruel. Anna looked closely at Aunt Quinlan's stepdaughter and wondered if she was unwell.
Mr. and Mrs. Lee are members of this household, Aunt Quinlan was saying. They are Catholic, and in case you've misremembered, they've taken the girls to church with them every Sunday.
Yes, and they are also...
Margaret lowered her voice and then was unable to go on.
Colored,
Sophie finished for her.
Well, yes, Margaret said.
And so am I.
But you're different, Margaret said, growing more flustered.
Aunt Quinlan closed her eyes for the span of 3 heartbeats. It was a rare thing to see her lose her temper,
but Margaret had managed to bring her to that point.
Margaret, she said with misleading calm, I believe you had a letter from your sons today.
Margaret started.
I did, but...
I take it they've decided to stay in Europe for another year. You miss them very much, I understand. Maybe it's time you joined them.
The color drained from Margaret's face.
But the girls, you needn't worry about the girls.
But I raised 5 daughters, Aunt Quinlan said more sharply, and a granddaughter and 2 nieces. I think I can be trusted with 2 more.
She turned to Sophie.
Have you and Cap decided on a date?
Hesitantly, Sophie said, Cap has legal matters to settle first. We would hope to sail at the end of May and marry that same morning. Cap's uncle Conrad has offered to give me away.
Conrad Belmont approved then, which was a relief. Some part of the family would be opposed and vocal, but the support of the eldest living Belmont would go a long way.
Just a small ceremony, Sophie said. For my side, just family and Mary and Abram Jacoby, if they will come.
Of course they will, Anna said. They have always been your champions.
Anna, for someone so relentlessly logical and clear-thinking, you can be oblivious, Margaret said, pushing back her chair to stand up. It doesn't matter if every physician in the city attends or if the president himself gives Sophie away. It is still the color of her skin that will be the sticking point.
For whom, exactly? Aunt Quinlan asked, her voice very low and calm. Who exactly are you worried about? Do you think you'll be cut in public because a niece of mine has married a Belmont?
Margaret did an admirable job of gathering her emotions and calming her voice. She folded her napkin and stood.
My mother was born in this house. I was born here, and so was my brother. The law may say that the house belongs to you as my father's widow, but in your heart, you know that it's wrong to put me out because I insist on speaking truths you would rather ignore.
This is getting out of hand, Anna said. Margaret, this is your home if you're away for a day or a year. No one is putting you out. No one is sending you away. Aunt Quinlan was making a suggestion, badly timed. She glanced at her aunt and frowned. But nothing more than a suggestion for you to take or leave.
Margaret's throat worked, but she said nothing.
After a moment, Aunt Quinlan said,
I spoke more sharply than I should have, Margaret. I apologize. You must decide what you want to do for yourself, but you can't decide anything for Sophie. And as a family, we will support her in her marriage, and we will find a way to keep the girls with us without sacrificing Cap's medical treatment.
The silence drew out for a long moment, and then Margaret turned and left them. The traffic lanes that fed onto the bridge from either side were still blocked off, and more than that, the terminal doors were closed. A sour-faced patrolman stood at the top of the stairs, scanning the street, as if he expected an invasion. But Jack never hesitated. He tipped his chin up at the patrolman. It seemed that this was the way police officers of all kinds acknowledged each other. And then he opened the door for Anna, and they walked past him and into the terminal to the sound of hammers and saws. Even on a Saturday after 7 in the evening, there were carpenters and painters and electricians working in the waning light. None of them took notice of 2 strangers walking through the terminal, but 2 roundsmen called out to Jack, gesturing him over. Anna supposed it was inevitable. He couldn't simply walk past a colleague without at least a short conversation. But she was so eager to be on the bridge that she found herself bouncing on the balls of her feet like a schoolgirl. The conversation had to do with boxing. She tried to fix her face in a politely uninterested way, and realized that she was failing
when Jack took her hand and tucked it into his coat pocket, where he squeezed it twice. "Be patient," was the message. She pinched him hard. One of the roundsmen was looking at her, a grandfatherly type with a great waterfall of gray mustache and a complexion so weather-roughened it looked more like tweed than skin. But he had a kind smile.
"You are looking forward to the bridge."
He had a German accent, which followed from the fact that Jack had called him Franz, but his shield bore the name Hannigan. It was not out of the ordinary in New York to have one Irish and one German parent, or two parents from opposite sides of the world, for that matter. Anna smiled back at him. "Very much."
"Lua," murmured his partner. "Vidi grua bla kriat vens lachacht. Was glaubst, Franz? Geht's dann e ering under a Handschuhe?"
And he winked at Jack, who spoke no German. Or, better said, Swiss. Because that was what they were speaking, oddly enough. She looked at Jack and was relieved to see him looking back at her, waiting for a translation. Before Anna could tell the man that there was not, in fact, a wedding ring under her glove, Officer Hannigan put the question to Jack in a more subtle way.
"Is this young lady a relative?"
Jack raised a brow and shot her a grin.
"Not yet."
After a startled silence that seemed to last an hour, Anna pulled away from him. "Na ja," she said to the roundsman in a voice nothing like her own, "das werden wir mal sehen." We'll just see about that. A short flight of stairs led down to the pedestrian walkway that stretched out before them, still cluttered with machinery, piles of wooden planks, wheels of wiring, and a dozen other things Anna couldn't put a name to. The first lampposts had been installed, but Anna could see that it would be a good while before the bridge could be lit at night. Below them, laborers were still busy on the train and omnibus tracks, but on the promenade, they were alone in a cathedral of cables aligned with such precision that Anna was reminded of the inner workings of a piano. She looked up at the pointed arches of the nearer tower and thought again of climbing it. She could see the ladder bolted to the stonework from where they stood.
"So," Jack said, "what did they say?"
"Who?"
He made a face at her.
Irritated, she sidestepped again. "Said about what?"
"They said something about you in German."
"No, they didn't. They were speaking Swiss."
"So you didn't understand?"
"They liked my dimples," Anna said. Jack made a sound in his throat.
"I'm sure there was something more to it than that. And what did you say to make them laugh like that?"
Anna shrugged, both unable and unwilling to open up the conversation. Instead, she ran ahead, pulling off her hat to feel the breeze on her face and neck. And she needed a moment to think. "Not yet." Jack teased. It was his nature. He enjoyed seeing her flustered. But he was never cruel or thoughtless. Or had never been. "Not yet." She stopped suddenly and turned to watch him walking toward her in long strides. He had left his hat in the terminal and the wind ruffled his hair. For that moment, he looked more like a boy of 20 than a man of 35. As he got closer, she said, "I don't want to talk about what you said to them. Not until I've told you some things you should know. You might as well change your mind about me. And," she added briskly, "I haven't made up my mind about you." He stopped so close to her that their shoes touched and smiled down at her.
"Liar."
But she would persist, and this accusation delivered with a grin could not make her forget what was at stake. The river was teeming with paddle boats and ferries, colliers, canal boats, barges and steamers and sailboats, all against the backdrop of the town of Brooklyn. She had never thought of Brooklyn as a particularly pretty place, its shoreline crowded with factories and warehouses and wharves. But from here, the highlands were a small sea of oak and maple and cedar trees, interspersed with blossoming cherry and crabapple, all punctuated by steeples and chimneys. She said, "I don't know what I'm looking at." And Jack came up behind her. He ducked down to follow her line of sight and with his hands on her shoulders, turned her a bit. "Wallabout Bay and the Navy Yard." As they turned steadily and he put names to ferry landings and landmarks, one arm dropped to circle her waist. "Fort Columbus, Governor's Island." He pointed and said, "You can just see Bedloe, where they're going to put up that statue from France, once they've got the money together, meant to welcome immigrants to the city." This was the cynic in Jack talking, a tone that she didn't often hear from him. A large steamliner was just passing the fort, headed for England or Greece, or on its way to round the Horn. Anna hesitated and then said what was on her mind. "Sophie and Cap will be getting married next month, and then they're going to Switzerland, to the clinic I told you about." He didn't seem surprised. "Is that what she really wants?" Anna thought for a long moment. "What she really wants is a cure, but this is as much as she can ask for." She shook her head, determined to put Margaret out of her mind for the moment, at least. Instead, she put her cheek against Jack's shoulder and, leaning into him, turned to follow the Manhattan shoreline. It was disquieting to realize that beyond Castle Garden and the spire of Trinity Church, there was almost nothing she recognized, as if she were looking at a city she had never visited before. Behind docks and wharves and warehouses, there were buildings of all sizes, crowded together like grubby blocks a child had poured out of a bag for no other reason than to see how they fell. All along the river shore to the right, the 7th District tenements leaned together like so many rotting teeth. But even there, poles were going up as electricity wove its way through the city streets, wires crisscrossing over every intersection. Smokestacks belched far above the buildings they topped. In the distance, the gasworks looked like a cluster of tin cans. There were patches of green here and there, but for the most part, it was a city of red brick and cast iron and warped wood, held together by grime and persistence. She said, "You can just see the Hudson from here." "From the top of the tower?" He paused. "Yes." She elbowed him less than gently. He used a hand to immobilize her arm. "Looking up there now, you still want to climb to the top?" She tipped her head back to consider. "I've climbed a couple of mountains," she said. "I don't suppose there are any bad-mannered goats on the way up that ladder, are there?" His face was so close she could count his eyelashes. When he spoke, his breath was warm on her face. "Do you dislike it that I am protective of you? Because that's bread in the bone." She straightened and patted his cheek. "I don't mind. As long as you'll take my yes I will as an answer to your no you won't." Jack gave a low laugh that she decided to read as surrender. They sat down on a bench that was so new the hardware shone, and Anna turned her attention back to the skyline. Dusk was drooping down, casting the kindest of lights over the worst of the city, a sugar glaze that might fool the eye for the few minutes it lasted. But it was her city, the only home she remembered. She had left once to test herself and come back again. She said, "Sometimes I work 12 or 14 hour days. I am called out, I would say, on average, 2 nights a week. And I will always be a doctor. I will never give up practicing medicine." "Yes," he said. "I recognize that about you. I see it." She hoped he was being honest with himself. Aunt Quinlan calls me a free thinker, but in fact, I'm an agnostic. I don't care what you believe if it gives you comfort, but I will not convert.
Jack nodded as if this were no surprise. Go on.
I'm not. I have. She was irritated with herself now. He was being his usual calm, rational self. She could be no less. She said, I'm not a virgin. My experience is narrow, but I'm not a virgin. I'll answer questions if you have them.
He shook his head, the muscle in his jaw rolling in a way she couldn't read. Is there more?
Yes, Anna said. I'm working up to it. She thought of Sophie, who had encouraged her to say these things, to be clear. Sophie, who would be Cap's widow, though she could be his wife only in name. She would bear the loss, and so could Anna. She said, I break the law on a regular basis and without remorse, and I will continue to break the law as long as I am able.
Contraceptives.
She let out a small sigh of relief at his matter-of-fact tone. Yes. I make information available in certain very strict circumstances, and I also provide recommendations, where possible. I am uncompromising about my patient's privacy and my own safety because I can't help anyone if I'm sitting in prison.
He was watching her. You've just confessed a crime to me. You trust me.
I do, Anna said, her voice catching. She waited until he nodded for her to go on. I do trust you. Am I wrong?
No. No hesitation, no doubt. She went on.
So you must know that whatever situation I find myself in eventually, with you or anyone else, I will use contraceptives until...
She stopped herself. Until?
Until the time is right.
He drew in a deep breath. I see. And after a moment, he said, It's better than the alternatives.
Do you think so? Anna wanted to touch his face but stopped herself. Do you mean it's better than bringing an unwanted child into the world, or it's better than abortion?
She had finally unsettled him. Both. He was still talking to her, which gave her the courage to tell him the rest.
I agree with you that it's better than the alternatives, but again, you should know.
Her voice was suddenly hoarse.
You should know that under certain circumstances, I would perform an abortion. I haven't yet, but I might someday. I don't know if you realize, but I would guess that at least 100 successful abortions are performed every month, in this city alone. Poorer women care for themselves, but hundreds of procedures are done by doctors and midwives, and done safely. You only hear about the cases that have gone wrong.
Is that something you see a lot?
All the time. Usually when a woman comes to the hospital after a badly done abortion, it's already too late. But I have never reported the few who survived. And I never will.
And their doctors?
I ask. But so far, no one has ever given me a name. I'm not sure what I would do in that case. It depends on the circumstances. Jack looked away over the river to the west. He was breathing deeply and evenly, and his arm stayed where it was, around her shoulders. As a minute passed, and then another, a deep sadness began to gather in the corners of what Sophie would call her heart, her vulnerable heart. He started to say something, paused.
Would you, he began, would you yourself?
Anna interrupted him. I can't imagine a situation where I would want an abortion for myself. She heard Sophie saying, Leave no room for misunderstanding. and she went on, reaching for the right words. But that is, at least in part, because I have reliable access to contraceptives and understand how they work. She held herself very still against him, aware of the pulse in his throat and wrists, the beat of his heart. In the next minutes, she might have to walk away or watch him walk away. But until then, she could be glad of his strength and warmth and the solid fact of him. The breeze turned cool as the sun slid over the edge of the world. Anna recited to herself the simplest truth. There was nothing more for her to say. She would not argue or reason or persuade. Not yet. Jack had heard himself say those two words. They were nothing but the truth. And still, he hadn't meant to speak them aloud. Not yet. And now she sat beside him, waiting for him to admit that she had been right. He had aunts who lived their lives in cloistered convents, a first cousin who was a Jesuit. He was a police officer sworn to uphold the law. She was not wrong to worry. If there were no more to him than those two facts, he would have no choice but to wish her well and go. Touch her face one last time, trace the line of her brow and jaw, the curve of her cheek. She was looking at him with such solemn purpose. If he left her now, he would never be able to cross this bridge without seeing her sitting on this bench, her hair undone by the wind, and loose curls falling across a cheek burnished red in the cool evening air. But he wouldn't leave her. He didn't want to. "Well," she said, shifting as if to move away from him and stand up. But he held her firmly and shook his head when she glanced at him. "Don't run off," he said. "There are things you should hear about me before you abandon ship." That got him a smile. Tentative, dimpleless, but a smile nonetheless. And she let herself be coaxed back to sit beside him, tucked into his side. "This is a very serious conversation for such a beautiful evening," he said after a while. She hummed her agreement, but didn't throw him the lifeline he was almost hoping for, so he took a deep breath. "You read in the paper how corrupt the police department is," he began, "and for the most part, the rumors are true." He told her about the storekeepers who pressed things into a cop's hands to gain his attention and good graces. He took his share of free meals, cab rides, cigars, bottles of whiskey. Once in a while, he studiously overlooked the sale of lottery tickets and went home with a few folded bills in his pocket. There were times he was rougher than he needed to be with criminals, and was responsible for a cracked rib or a bloody nose now and then. On occasion, he had let somebody stew in the tombs for an extra couple of days, until he could make a case that would stick in front of a judge. He had some rules that he didn't break. He never arrested a hungry child for stealing. He'd settle things with the grocer or baker or tavern keeper, and then send the kid on his way with a warning. He wasn't rough with women or cripples or the feeble-minded, though he had had cause on more than one occasion. Jack looked down at her and waited until she raised her head to meet his gaze. "Unless there is a felony or children are involved, I don't arrest prostitutes," he said, "male or female. And I never take bribes from them or the people they work for. There are other things, most of them pretty small. Right now, what you really need to know is, I paid more than one bribe to get on the police force, and then again to get promoted."
"Ah," she said, "because you're Italian."
He shook his head. "Everybody pays. It helped that they needed another detective who speaks Italian, but sure, I still paid more than I would have if I had an Irish last name. The plain fact is, nothing happens without money changing hands.
There are more than a few cops out there who would make good detectives, but they'll walk a beat until they drop dead because they don't have money or the right connections. And there are crooks and worse in the city who have never spent a day in jail and never will. Every saloon keeper pays, every week. The same is true for dance halls and gambling joints and opium dens and disorderly houses. The ones you read about in the paper, the ones who do end up in jail, are almost always there because they couldn't or wouldn't pay the bribe.
She was watching him calmly, waiting. Are you a part of that?
Jack shook his head. I'm not a beat cop.
But you like it, your job, what you do.
Most of the time, yes.
That's something to be thankful for. She surprised him. Again.
Jack flagged down a cab and helped her in, gave directions to the cabbie, and took the moment to gather his thoughts. His heart was racing, and he had broken out in a sweat despite the cool night air. But he could wait. He would have to wait until she was ready to talk. As they set off down Prince Street, he said,
Are we still going to the Foundling tomorrow?
She gave him a curious half-smile.
Why wouldn't we?
The cab went around the park before stopping at the corner, where Fifth Avenue South met Washington Square. Jack helped her out without a word of explanation. He wanted to walk with her here because he had more to say. The very idea made her throat go dry. He stood there, his hand extended, and she took it.
You don't walk here at night alone.
He wasn't asking her a question, but voicing a command of sorts. She might take exception to commands, but she understood his concerns. The streetlights make a great difference, and there's nothing to fear from prostitutes.
It's not the women you need to be wary of, Jack said.
She let out a sigh.
I'm very aware of that. I don't go through the park in the dark of night alone, but I do know every square inch of it. It was our playground when we were little, and later we...
She couldn't help grinning at the memory.
He raised a brow. Go on.
You saw that Margaret reads the Police Gazette, almost obsessively, I would say. She would talk about some of the crimes at the dinner table. Nothing violent, not when we were children. But she'd say, Colonel Maxwell was burgled yesterday, every piece of silver in the house. And then she'd voice her opinion. Usually she'd say, I suspect the help. Or she'd be specific. They hired that Irish cook. Aunt Quinlan would take exception and there would be a pointed discussion. Aunt never shielded us from this kind of thing. And eventually, we were curious about the bits of the Police Gazette Margaret wasn't reading to us.
Cap,
she laughed. It was his idea to wait until she had finished with one, and then he'd snatch up the cast-off before it could be burned. We read to each other in a corner somewhere about people who had been robbed on the street, corners where a fight broke out. Eventually, we got up the courage, and when we came across something that happened anywhere near us, we went to investigate. It didn't take long to notice that the police spent a lot of time just a few blocks away.
Frenchtown, Jack supplied,
and she nodded.
We didn't know the neighborhood had a name. We knew the cafes and the bakery and the fact that everyone speaks French. Sophie was our ambassador when we went exploring there. But it wasn't until we started studying the Gazette that we heard about the Tavern Alsacienne being raided and the disorderly houses. The memory made her laugh.
Tell me you didn't stop by the Alsacienne to sample their absinthe, Jack said.
No, I was thinking about a terrific argument we had about a raid on a disorderly house on Green Street. We didn't know what a disorderly house was at first, and Sophie got into a laughing fit imagining housekeepers being arrested because of dust bunnies under their beds.
Cap did know what a disorderly house was, but he wouldn't tell us. So we went to Aunt Quinlan.
She told you?
Jack looked both surprised and unsettled at this idea.
Aunt Quinlan always answered our questions, no matter how odd or difficult. Or painful, Anna thought.
As I remember, it wasn't a long conversation. She didn't condone or condemn, but she talked about the way poor women live. I thought I understood what she was saying, but I didn't. I couldn't, really, at that age. But I do now.
Jack made a low humming sound, as if he were thinking this through, and then he pulled her closer.
I'm wondering what made you think of dust bunnies and the Police Gazette just now.
Anna felt herself flush with irritation, at herself and Jack both. He had figured out what she was thinking before she realized it herself, and she felt the sting of that.
This was what came of raising the subject of sex, she told herself.
Her rational mind knew that a healthy man of 35 did not live like a monk, and further, that she had no right to judge him on that basis. But the idea of Jack Mezzanotte visiting prostitutes sat badly with her, and she couldn't pretend otherwise. And so she asked, "Do you have allegiances I should know about?" He was trying to look serious, and really, Anna thought, he could be insufferable at times, standing in a pool of light from a lamppost, a curl of dark hair falling over his brow. He grinned at her and then, leaning down, kissed her forehead. She batted at him.
What was that for?
Jack caught her hand and pressed it to his chest, holding it there and pulling her in. Then he kissed her properly, the kind of kiss she had been expecting on the bridge, the kind of kiss that made everything else go away, slow and soft and deep. His tongue stroked hers. She made a noise of surrender.
We'll get arrested, she said against his mouth.
Not a chance.
She cursed the lamplight, but went to him with an enthusiasm she couldn't begin to hide. When his hand began to trace the curve of her hip, she tried again.
We'll be charged with indecent behavior.
That made him laugh. I'll show you what counts as indecent behavior.
This time she managed to pull herself away, and they stood a few feet apart, both breathing as though they had run a mile uphill. She said,
Are you going to answer my question?
Jack rubbed a hand over his face like a man trying to rouse himself out of sleep.
About my allegiances? I don't have any.
She raised a brow, crossed her arms, waited.
At the moment.
He was trying not to smile, but the corner of his mouth jerked.
My last allegiance ended at the new year.
Because?
She was a widow. She moved away to keep house for her widowed brother-in-law in St. Louis, with the intention of marrying him. We separated on good terms. Satisfied?
Not really.
That seems insufficient for a man of your age and vitality.
I play handball, he said. That settles things down for a while.
Handball was played all over the city, a hard game involving nothing more than the ball itself and walls. Watching teenage boys playing handball when she herself was a teenager had been unsettling in ways she didn't understand at the time. Now the idea of Jack playing handball, sweat-soaked, his muscles working, made her swallow.
He mistook her silence for something else.
Jack put his hands on her face and lifted it to the lamplight.
I don't frequent disorderly houses. Even if I were tempted, the possibility of syphilis would stop me.
She put her forehead to his shoulder and nodded.
That's a relief.
After a long moment, he said,
What are you thinking?
About you playing handball?
That made him laugh. When I get back from Chicago, you can come watch.
I'll miss you. You'll be too busy to miss anybody, I'd guess.
Hard to imagine.
From deeper in the park came the sound of a woman's laugh, high-pitched and less than sober. It roused them both out of their thoughts.
So tomorrow we'll go to the Foundling. And then while I'm away, you'll figure out what you want.
He pressed his thumb to her mouth before she could say anything.
I already know what I want, Savard. I'm just waiting for you to catch up.
Chapter 15. The engagement announcement in Sunday morning's paper took up a full third of the society news column, 10 copies of which were on the breakfast table, arranged by Mrs. Lee before anyone had gotten out of bed. Breakfast itself was delayed for a half hour while each of them studied what Cap had written. Leah sat on Margaret's lap, and Rosa sat between Anna and Sophie, her concentration drifting away, her face creased with worry. If Margaret was right about nothing else, Anna knew it was important that these girls had no doubt about their place in the household. Aunt Quinlan and Margaret agreed that the whole piece was well done. Margaret was more settled this morning. A fact that followed, Anna believed, from the invitation that had arrived by messenger at 9 o'clock exactly. The family was invited to take dinner and spend the afternoon and evening on Park Place to celebrate the engagement. Anna did not doubt for a moment that Cap had anticipated Margaret's objections and that this was his countermeasure. Margaret was going over the announcement again.
The wording is perfect, she admitted, but then I'd expect nothing less from a lawyer of Cap's standing.
Peter Belmont Verhoeven, Esquire, son of the deceased Anton Verhoeven and Clorinda Belmont Verhoeven, is pleased to announce his engagement to be married to Dr. Sophie Adélie Savard, a graduate of the Women's Medical School of the New York Infirmary for Women and Children, and a native of New Orleans. The wedding will take place in the later part of May. Because Mr. Verhoeven has been in ill health, he and his affianced request that no parties or receptions be planned or proposed.
This won't keep people from calling, Aunt Quinlan said. This afternoon there will be a steady river of people to present their cards, but we won't be here to be bothered. Very clever of Cap to arrange things this way.
He is entirely too clever, Sophie agreed with a grim smile.
Some of his old spirit is resurfacing, Anna observed. Sophie said,
Oh yes, the dry humor he uses to such devastating effect is already showing itself. I think he will have more than one surprise waiting for us this afternoon, but I have an appointment at the New Amsterdam at 11 that I can't miss.
It was decided that Sophie would meet with the younger Sam Reason as arranged, and join them at Cap's at noon, while Anna would stay for dinner and then leave straight away for her appointment at the Foundling with Jack Mezzanotte. As soon as the words were said, Anna wished she had not spoken at all, because Rosa was suddenly brimming with tension. She looked at Anna with a question written so plainly on her face, it was impossible to pretend not to see it.
We hope for the best, she told Rosa.
But even if there is no word at the Foundling, we are far from exhausting all possibilities. Margaret was frowning at her. Anna was quite aware of that without looking up. Leah had taken note of the change in the mood around the table, and she climbed down from Margaret's lap to stand beside her sister. Aunt Quinlan said,
Come, girls, come to me. We have some things to talk about before you get ready for the party. I need to know if you are willing to help me with the wedding preparations. And there's the matter of wedding cake to discuss.
At 10,
Sophie knocked on Sister Xavier's door and was summoned in with a gruff, "Ave." The charge nurse warned her that the older nun was recovering quickly, both physically and mentally. The return of her taciturn disposition was a solid indication of improvement. Sister Xavier sat propped up in bed, surrounded by newspapers, spectacles perched on the end of her nose. With her full cheeks flushed red and the white cap tied so firmly under her chin, she reminded Sophie of old Mother Hubbard. Then Xavier made a sound much like the honk of an angry goose, and the image of the kindly grandmother was gone. She caught sight of Sophie with a stethoscope around her neck, and her expression shifted to confusion.
"I'm Dr. Sophie Savard, looking after Anna Savard's patients today. May I examine you, sister?"
The nun flushed and fumbled her newspaper in a way Sophie thought must be out of character. From all reports, this was not a shy or easily intimidated woman.
"You're the cousin?"
"Yes."
"She's as pale as milk,"
Sister Xavier said, as if this were news to Sophie.
"And you're colored."
Sophie didn't often explain, but there was something disarming about the unabashed way in which the obvious had been laid out.
"Yes," she said, "my grandmother and Anna's mother were half-sisters. They had the same father but different mothers. Technically, I believe we are half-cousins. Would you rather I didn't examine you?"
The heavy jaw worked for a moment.
"I'm not sure."
Sophie sat beside the bed.
"You don't appear to have a fever, which means that post-surgical infection is unlikely. Any pain?"
"A twinge now and then when I lift my arm. Nothing, really."
She might be lying, as most patients lied when they wanted something or did not want something specific from a doctor. But Sophie couldn't force Sister Xavier's confidence, and it would be a waste of time to try.
"As there's no sign of a fever, it can wait until the other Dr. Savard sees you tomorrow, if you would be more comfortable."
There was a drawn-out moment while Sister Xavier struggled with her scruples. Finally, she said,
"You really are a doctor."
"Fully trained and qualified," Sophie assured her. "If you're wondering about your tumor, I can tell you that it looked to be benign, not malignant, though sometimes it is hard to know for sure. I would say that it is unlikely to reoccur."
"Then why do I sit here?"
"Until the incision is fully closed, infection is still a possibility. Well,"
she stood, and then sat again, because Sister Xavier was pointing at the chair, simply pointing, as if she were a student who had dared to rise without permission.
"Sister Mary Augustine is off somewhere," she said. "I think you should spend at least a little while here in compensation."
She thrust a pile of newspaper at Sophie.
"Read to me. My eyes can't cope with the fine print anymore, even with spectacles."
Sophie took the paper.
"What kind of news do you want to hear?"
A hand rose and fell.
"Anything," she said.
"Here's a story about the mayor."
"Anything but the mayor."
Sophie's suggestions were dismissed one by one until she gave up.
"You don't want to hear me reading the paper," she said.
"I do," Sister Xavier insisted. "Just find something interesting."
Sophie said a small, quiet word of thanks that the sister wasn't interested in the society column. She did want to hear a story about a fight between Irish and Italians that had sent four men to the hospital. She listened closely to stories about a robbery, a murder on a train, and a police raid on an opium den. A knock at the door brought Sophie's reading to a close.
"That will be my appointment. If I have time, I'll come back later to read this story about a knifing on the White Line dock, or this one,
about the body of an unidentified woman in Battery Park.
Thank you, Sister Xavier said with a sniff. I would like that.
Sophie was still laughing a little to herself when she got to her office and found the younger Sam Reason sitting on a chair in the hall. He stood when he saw her. A tall man, as straight as a rifle and lean, wiry in the way of men who worked hard and were abstemious in their habits. He was no more than 30, and he bore no resemblance to his grandparents. As Sophie remembered New Orleans, most people of color were some shade of brown, from her own pale caramel to the dark brown of rich earth, and New York was much the same. But Sam Reason was far darker, a deep black that stood out all the more for the crisp white of his shirt collar. She wondered if he might be adopted, and then put the idea aside as irrelevant, and more important, none of her business. He had a good, if somewhat somber, smile, and he shook her hand without hesitation, firmly, as her father had taught her was proper. His voice was much like his skin color, very deep and rich in tone. There was a rasp that might mean nothing more than a stubborn cold, but sounded to Sophie like an older injury to his vocal cords.
Thank you for seeing me.
He followed her into the office and took the chair she indicated, with his hat in his lap and the heels of his hands on his knees.
I don't mean to interrupt your work.
I'm not even on duty, Sophie told him, and your time is as important as mine.
She brought the desk chair out so that she could sit across from him without a barrier.
I'm just sorry to meet you under these circumstances. My sincere condolences to your grandfather's death. I didn't know him well, but I liked him very much.
The feeling was mutual, Dr. Savard.
Please call me Sophie.
It's an honor. Thank you. I'm Sam.
Now that she had a chance to study him more closely, Sophie noted that the beds of his fingernails were ink-stained, and that reminded her why he had come.
I expect you heard the basics about the trouble that Dr. Garrison was in.
From my grandfather, yes. That's all settled now?
Yes and no,
Sophie said. She told him a little about Comstock and his crusade, and the most recent attempt to send Dr. Garrison to the penitentiary.
And I doubt he's given up. He'll do his best to entrap her, and that's where your business comes in. The pamphlets Comstock brought into the courtroom as evidence were your grandfather's work. The only reason he wasn't arrested was that he didn't put his name or the company name on the materials he printed for us.
She paused, and he nodded for her to go on.
My first question for you is whether you would prefer us to find a different printer.
He studied his hands for a moment longer.
There's no reason you should know this, but I just recently took over the business when I moved back home from Savannah. I'm not even sure what my grandfather was printing for you.
Sophie went to her desk, unlocked a drawer, and took out a slim stack of pamphlets. Personal Hygiene, The Well-Considered Family, A Woman's Health, The Human Reproductive Cycle. When he had looked over them briefly, he said,
Dr. Garrison wrote these?
In part. A number of different physicians have had a hand in putting them together, including me. What you need to understand is that if you continue printing these pamphlets, you will place yourself in harm's way.
She wondered if she would have to be more explicit. He put the pamphlets on her desk.
According to the account books, Dr. Garrison is an excellent customer. My grandfather had no complaints about her or the work she brought to him. I think we can continue on in the same way. Do I have to introduce myself to her?
No. Sophie said, given the close attention Comstock is paying to her, The committee has decided to have her step back for the present. I had planned on taking over for her, but I've had a change in circumstance quite suddenly and will be away for as much as...
Her voice roughened.
As a year. She could see that he was curious, but Sophie didn't want to open the discussion of where she would be or with whom. She took a deep breath and continued.
Early next week, we'll have to decide who will take over the business end of things, and I will send you word if you decide you want to continue. But I think it's important you understand the seriousness of this situation before you decide.
He inclined his head in what might have been reluctant agreement.
Comstock has made an art out of entrapment by mail, Sophie began. He writes a letter to a doctor and pretends to be a young woman who has gotten in trouble without the benefit of marriage, pleading for help.
Sam Reason was frowning.
He signs someone else's name?
He makes up a story about someone who doesn't exist and signs that person's name.
Always a young woman?
Sophie paused.
For the most part. There's the possibility that he sometimes writes as a man needing help for his wife. He does send both men and women to try to entrap physicians in their offices. Whoever he sends always has a convincing story about a desperate need for contraceptives or abortion. We've been approached more than once.
We?
Pardon me, I haven't explained clearly. I live with an aunt and a cousin. My cousin Anna is also a physician.
Comstock seems to be interested in both of us.
There are two of you?
He seemed amused by the idea.
Two black women practicing medicine in the city.
She is my half-cousin, Sophie explained, and she is white. There are other women of color practicing medicine here and elsewhere. A few of us and more every year.
He started to say something, and then stopped to listen, though he was clearly disturbed by what she was telling him. She went on to relate a cautionary tale that happened to be true. It was Dr. Newlight's history that kept physicians awake at night. He had received one of Comstock's entrapment letters and responded by sending a prescription for bismuth and gentian powder, a mild treatment for digestive ailments.
For that he was convicted under the Comstock Act. He spent almost 2 years in the penitentiary.
Almost reluctantly, he asked,
"What this doctor sent wasn't illegal?"
"Nothing illegal about it. But the judge ruled that by responding to the decoy letter he had committed a crime. He wouldn't allow Dr. Newlight's attorney to call any witnesses. He simply instructed the jury to find the doctor guilty, and that's what they did."
She watched him think this through.
"You know," he said,
and there was a good dose of cynicism in his voice.
"Stories like that are not all that unusual, at least when the man sitting trial is black. I assume this Dr. Newlight is a white man, and that's why it strikes you as unjust."
She drew up, surprised.
"Are you suggesting that the jail sentence was appropriate because Dr. Newlight is white?"
"I'm just reminding you that black men are sent to jail or worse every day for far less reason."
He met her gaze unapologetically. Sophie's training had deprived her of the ability to be embarrassed. But she understood when her intelligence and morals had been insulted. She felt her temper slip out of her grasp.
"You don't need to educate me about what it means to be black," she told Sam Reason. "I spent my first 10 years in New Orleans. As soon as I learned how to write my name, I also learned that I could never sign anything without identifying myself as a free woman of color. It's not required in New York, but I still pause sometimes and feel a moment of panic because I forgot to write FWC after my signature."
My father and my grandmother, neither of them white, were doctors who looked after the poor, as I do. I see dozens of patients every week, and almost all of them are some shade of brown or black or yellow, and poor. So yes, I am aware. In some ways more aware than you will ever be. I doubt you have ever had to treat a woman who has had a baby beaten out of her by a drunk husband. That happens far too often to women of every color and age. She saw little reaction in his expression beyond a steady and unwavering regard. He asked,
"Why do you defend this Dr. Newlight?"
I was not defending him. The story was meant to make clear to you how dangerous this business really is. What is bothering you? That I am sympathetic to a colleague who happens to be white, or that I have white relations?
He said, "You want me to understand that this Comstock will do just about anything to send somebody to jail, and the truth don't matter much one way or the other, as long as he gets his few minutes of glory."
"Yes," Sophie said, "exactly. He has no respect for freedom of speech or freedom of the press or even basic civil liberties."
"And you're thinking maybe I won't want your business anymore because of that."
"I wanted you to have a full understanding of the dangers before you made any kind of commitment," she said.
"You want to absolve yourself of responsibility before the fact."
Sophie stood suddenly, pushing her chair back so abruptly that it tipped over and fell. Sam stood too, more slowly. "I believe you've answered my question," she said, her voice shaking with anger. "I will find another printer. Thank you for your time, and please give your grandmother and family my condolences and best wishes." She walked to the door and opened it, standing back to let him pass. But he stayed where he was, turning his hat in his hands.
"I apologize," he said,
his accent softening and taking on more of a southern rhythm.
"I was rude and unfair. Can we start again?"
Sophie closed the door and returned to the chair he had straightened for her, but she had to fold her hands together in her lap to keep them from trembling. "I accept your apology," Sophie forced herself to meet his gaze. "But I don't think I can work with someone who holds me in such low regard."
"I don't hold you in low regard, just the opposite."
"Then I'm at a loss to understand your animosity. Have I offended you somehow?" And suddenly, she understood. "You saw the announcement about my engagement in the paper today." She saw the answer in the way his jaw tightened very slightly. He nodded.
"I did see that. Please accept my best wishes."
Sophie couldn't help herself. She let out a soft laugh. "Very convincing, Sam." He turned his head away for a moment.
"To start over at the beginning, I understand the dangers and I'd like to continue the business relationship."
Sophie studied the material of her dress, following the dark blue scrollwork pattern she had worn because she would leave here to go to a party in celebration of her engagement. She thought of the Reason family and the hour she had spent sitting with them at their table, the kindness and open affection they showed each other. Somehow she believed, she wanted to believe, that Delilah Reason and her daughters would not be so condemning as the man who sat opposite her. She wanted to end the meeting and get away, but she reminded herself that her feelings were secondary to the business that needed to be conducted. "If you have the time, I'd like to send you back home with a new order."
"Yes," he said, "I have the time."
For a half hour, they talked about paper and binding and printing costs. And during that whole time,
Sophie had the strong impression that Sam Reason was forbidding himself to look at her, for fear that doing so would turn him to a pillar of salt. The Foundling Hospital, run by the Sisters of Charity, was well beyond the city proper, and so Jack rented a surrey. He stopped first at the hospital to pick up Sister Mary Augustine, who was coming along to provide an introduction, and then on Waverly Place for Anna, only to be told she wasn't in. Instead, Mrs. Lee handed him a note.
Mezzanotte. Please call for me at Cap's, the house at the northwest corner of 36th Street and Park Place. I will be ready to leave when you arrive. Savard.
He asked Mrs. Lee straight out,
"Is Cap poorly?"
She frowned so completely that it seemed as though the corners of her mouth might meet on her chin.
"Why would you say something like that? It's just an engagement party for Sophie and Cap."
Now she was craning her head around him and smiling, waving at Sister Mary Augustine, who waved back cheerfully. She put the frown back on for him.
"Go on now, she'll be waiting for you. Young people stumbling over their own feet."
She was laughing to herself as she closed the door. Cap lived on Park Place, a wide avenue divided down the middle by islands of greenery and trees. Old money for the most part, and families far longer established than the magnates who built their mansions on Upper Fifth Avenue. The house itself was very large, a formidable limestone and marble square with tall windows on all three floors. Elegant, almost regal in its lines. As Jack brought the surrey to a stop, the door opened and Anna came out, flew down the short flight of stairs, and almost leapt up without waiting for assistance, settling beside Sister Mary Augustine when the spot next to Jack was just as empty. He was too busy threading his way back into traffic to ask for her explanations, and he was irritated, too, because she would know that and was making him wait anyway. It took 5 full blocks for the traffic to thin out and the team to settle down, and then he turned to look at her. She was looking at him, too, and smiling. It was the kind of smile he didn't see very often from her, wide and open and unreserved.
What?
She shook her head and shrugged her shoulders all at once. Cap and Sophie announced their engagement, and at least some of his family sent notes to wish them well.
And why wouldn't they? Sister Mary Augustine wanted to know.
Anna's expression shifted into something more familiar, thoughtful concern, calculation. Jack turned his attention back to the team. But he was listening.
"It's a complicated story," Anna said to Mary Augustine. "And really, it's too fine a day to bother with unhappy details."
It struck Jack that two women could hardly look less alike. Sister Mary Augustine in her white bonnet and habit, so pale that he could see a network of veins in her temples, and Anna dressed as she always was for work. Very proper and severe. She wore a dark skirt and jacket, and under that, a white shirt waist with a short-standing collar that accentuated the line of her jaw. There was a cameo pinned at the throat, but otherwise she wore no jewelry at all. And still, if he closed his eyes, he could still see Anna turning to catch a silk scarf in the light of a dozen lanterns. Long-necked and bare-armed, smiling at the footman, a pearl comb in her coiled dark hair. Until he met Anna, Jack had never given much thought to fashion, beyond the awareness that it was a ruling force in the lives of many women and enslaved some of them as surely as chains. Anna cared about her appearance, but that was evident only if a man looked closely and saw the details. He only knew what to look for because of his sisters, who talked of little else, not in the way of young girls wishing for finery, but as women who had made a profession out of producing beautiful things. Anna's kidskin gloves were embroidered at the cuff. The buttons on her jacket were finely carved mother of pearl and jet, and every pleater fold was pressed to a sharp edge. Today, she had forsaken her usual bonnet for a simple felt hat with a rim that rolled up over one ear. Its only decoration was a small bunch of silk flowers, a few fat white rosebuds, a twig of deep red berries, and a spray of ivy. Jack tried to imagine a third woman there as well, some well-bred lady in Sunday finery, blue or pink or yellow, with flounces and lace and ruffles and a bustle like a giant melon. To put a hand on that woman's waist would be like to grasp something inanimate and inflexible and cold. Nothing like Anna at all. He had given up trying to put the idea of touching Anna out of his mind, mostly, he could admit to himself, because he didn't want to and saw no reason for it. Not after their discussion the evening before. There was a hollow feeling in his gut when he thought of her. Unfamiliar nerves sparking to life the closer she was. They were traveling north on Lexington, leaving paving stones behind for a well-traveled dirt road at 50th Street. A block to the west, mansions were springing up along Fifth, their broad, cold faces turned to the vast expanse of Central Park.
"So many different greens," he heard Sister Mary Augustine say. "A world of greens,"
Anna said.
"The park in spring always makes me think about my Aunt Quinlan. She's an artist, or she was until arthritis put an end to it. When she was still working, she spent every morning in her studio. At noon, she'd come downstairs and scrub her hands at the kitchen sink, and she'd talk to me about the colors she was washing away. The names for all the kinds of green and yellow made sense to me. Jade, celadon, verdigris, malachite, moss and myrtle, and chartreuse, aureoline, and jasmine." Jack glanced at her over his shoulder and she ducked her head, as if he had overheard an embarrassing revelation. They passed an abandoned shanty, fields dotted with sheep and new lambs and dairy cows. At an intersection, signs were nailed to a post. Milk and eggs for sale, yearling colts, pigs, a plow. Small clusters of houses sprang up, some of them close to collapse, but others with whitewashed fences and bright clean window glass. The city was pushing north, as unstoppable as the tide. Sister Mary Augustine was very far away in her thoughts, all her attention on the countryside. A man mending a fence, a young woman at work in a garden with a shallow basket balanced between hip and an extended arm, a grove of apple trees where children sat in the branches and pelted each other with hard green fruit no bigger than walnuts. Anna asked Mary Augustine a question Jack would not have thought to ask of a nun. "I think you must have grown up on a farm." "What makes you say that?"
Anna shrugged.
"Just the way you're watching things. Do you miss it?" "I didn't think I would when I first left home, but I suppose I do. The smell of newly turned earth in the spring air makes me homesick. The new lambs and foals were always my favorite thing."
After a few moments of silence, she went on.
"I have 6 brothers. They were always falling out of trees and cutting themselves and dropping spades on their feet or beating each other bloody. I had a talent for patching them up. Mama wanted me to be a nun, and I wanted to be a nurse."
"I'm surprised she could let you go at all, with so many children to look after." Mary Augustine smiled.
"She's got 2 sisters, and neither of them ever married. The 3 of them keep the house while my father runs the farm with the boys."
"And they sent you off to the convent?"
"It wasn't meant to be a punishment. Mama said she wanted a quieter life for me. The Sisters of Charity are a nursing order, so we were both satisfied. But,"
She paused and looked at Anna.